Hi, listeners. Dominic here. We're taking a little break this week, but we've got something different for you. It's an episode swap with our friends over at Deutsche Welle's Inside Europe podcast. Think of it as a little example of cross-border European podcasting collaboration. We'll be back next week, and that episode of our show will also be appearing in their feed. For now, sit back and enjoy this episode of Inside Europe from Deutsche Welle.
Hello, I'm Kate Laycock, host of Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. This week, we're taking a break from normal programming in order to make a space for grief.
It does open something up, and you are able, I think, to imagine something different because it's no longer possible to deny that massive transformations are here.
That's Sarah Jaffe, author of From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire. She'll be my guest and guide this week as we explore what it might mean to look at global events through the lens of loss. If this is a topic that you find difficult, then do feel free to sit this episode out. For everyone else, welcome. A storm was breaking over New Orleans when I spoke to Sarah Jaffe, author of From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire. No, not that storm. Our conversation only happened a couple of weeks ago. But of course, in New Orleans, every storm carries with it an echo of Katrina.
The city has been remade by a hurricane. And then each hurricane that comes, you see and feel the trauma and the damage that that one left behind. And you can see it in the landscape of the city now. You know, there are still houses with the X's painted on them that people were using to indicate that the house had been checked to see if there were any survivors in it.
Sarah Jaffe had lived in New Orleans as a child. She moved back as an adult following the death of her father in 2018. It was an event, she says, which changed everything.
You know, my father died and it turned my life upside down in ways that I did not expect and could not have foreseen. And, you know, I have been a journalist for quite a long time. I have been reporting on social movements for quite a long time. But after he died, I started to realize the grief that was embedded in sort of everything I was reporting on. And to use that as a lens to understand the stories that I'd already been sort of obsessed with telling.
Sarah's a journalist and author with a long-term interest in the politics of the streets and of the workplace. Before From the Ashes, her last book was called Work Won't Love You Back. Through her own experience, she came to see grief as something akin to the sand in the machine, the thing that refuses to be limited in time and space and that makes you incapable of going back to normal, of slotting back into your old life and your old job.
And all of that became much more visible to me because I was going through something that didn't let me put it down. That grief was so visceral, it was so physical, it was something that was like happening in my body. I couldn't sort of tune it out for the day to go about my day job and then pick it up again when I had time.
And yet, when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, that was exactly what so many of us were expected to do. Not all of us, of course, because as Sarah points out, the pandemic was experienced very differently by different categories of people. Those in jobs considered system relevant who had to keep working, those who lost their jobs, and those who were able to work from home.
The people who were experiencing the pandemic, the people who died, the people who got sick, the people who were taking care of the sick, were those in the first category of those who were still going to work. When I talked to doctors, nurses, hospital workers, healthcare workers, they were experiencing the pandemic in a much, much, much more intense way than the rest of us were. So the doctors and the nurses who were there, those are the only people who are there with people as they're dying. And that's just this, like, incredibly, again, traumatic experience that so many of these workers are still carrying, and they're still just going to work.
In From the Ashes, Sarah Jaffe explores the ways in which the COVID-19 pandemic lay bare the logic of whose lives were considered expendable. One of her key case studies is the Italian city of Bergamo, the epicentre of the pandemic in Europe. An industrial city powered by poorly paid workers, often with a migration background, working in factories and warehouses. A city which was considered too economically important to shut down.
The haunting thing about that, right, was it being referred to by, I believe, one of the industrialists as this is one of the economic lungs of this country. And so it has to keep going. And I was like, right, but like the lungs of actual humans are stopping. Because we have to keep the economic lungs going.
We'll be hearing more from Sarah Jaffe throughout the programme. But first, I want to take you to Bergamo itself. 5 years have passed since military vehicles drove through the streets, removing the bodies of the dead. Now, Bergamo is busy and indeed booming. But for many, the scars still remain, as we'll hear in this report from Angelo van Schaik.
The monumental cemetery in Bergamo. And there's a special field where all the victims of the COVID pandemic are buried. And I read the dates of death. July 14th, 2020. July 15th, 2020. February 2nd, 2020. July 30th, 2020, August 6th, August 7th, August 9th, August 13th. And these were the people who were, so to speak, lucky to find a spot on the cemetery, while many more were taken away from Bergamo and cremated and buried somewhere else. Like Consuelo, Locati's father.
Ho visto mio papà l'ultima volta l'11 marzo e l'ho riabbracciato il 20 di aprile.
The last time I saw my dad was on March 11th, and I embraced him again on April 20th in an urn. After my father died, I started to call all the crematoriums in different regions, and I found out he was taken to Florence.
Mio papà era stato portato a Firenze.
It's the early morning of March 18th, 2020, when a convoy of military vehicles take the first 73 bodies of COVID-19 victims away from Bergamo to be cremated in other Italian cities. The city's crematorium was working 24 hours a day, but couldn't handle the sheer volume of bodies. In the early weeks of March 2020, 60 to 70 Bergamaschi were dying of COVID-19 every single day. Giorgio Gori was the mayor at that time.
I camion partirono di notte, con l'idea che di notte insomma sarebbero stati notati meno, che quindi non si sarebbe diffuso.
The trucks left at night to avoid causing even more distress to the population. But they were seen by a Ryanair steward who lives on the street near the cemetery, who heard the sound of the engines, got out onto his terrace and filmed the trucks. He posted the video on social media and it went almost instantly viral. Finally, Italy and the world understood what was happening in Bergamo.
The province of Bergamo, with nearly 7,000 official victims out of 1.1 million inhabitants, was the hardest hit area in the Western world during the first wave of the coronavirus in the spring of 2020. One of the reasons Bergamo was hit so hard is the omission to install a so-called red zone. Confindustria Bergamo, the powerful organization of industrial entrepreneurs, put pressure on the regional and national government to not close Bergamo immediately after the first COVID-19 cases were found. The province of Bergamo is one of Italy's most vital economical strongholds. It is too important to shut down, Confindustria argued. Lombardy's President Fontana and Prime Minister Conte gave in to the pressure. Workers in plants and warehouses were exposed to the virus without the necessary protection. Many of them fell ill and died.
il nostro paese non ha saputo e non ha potuto contenere la strage.
Our government wasn't able to protect us from the tragedy that hit us in Bergamo because we didn't have the tools which we were supposed to have, like the red zone.
Dovevamo avere e la zona rossa nella bergamasca, il cosiddetto lockdown.
A local lockdown, which was imposed before in other parts of northern Italy when infections were found, wasn't imposed because of economic reasons. Production was worth more than a human life.
Che la vita umana conta meno della produttività.
That's exactly what Francesca Nava states in her book Il Focolaio. The outbreak in English. Nava is a journalist who was born and raised in Bergamo. During the pandemic, she decided to return home from Rome, where she works for the Italian public television. She stayed in Bergamo for 3 months in a friend's apartment by herself, far away from her son. Working hard, although sometimes work was impossible, as the emotional toll of what she had set out to document was so high.
La Bergamasca e Bergamaschi hanno pagato un prezzo altissimo.
Bergamo has paid a high price. Only after the military trucks on March 18th, they decided to close everything, also the factories. Bergamo saved Italy, but I'm afraid those deaths were in vain. No lesson was learned. The Italian National Health Service is suffering from lack of investments.
Che è in agonia.
At the peak of the wave, more than 100 people per day died from the virus. Before the first trucks left the northern Italian city, the coffins were stored on three locations in Bergamo, one of which was the San Giuseppe Church in Seriate, just outside the city. Priest Mario Carminati recalls the enormous emotional impact.
Io ho potuto uscire, ma ho potuto uscire per vedere dei morti.
While everyone was at home, I could go out, but only to see the deceased, a lot of them. If I count the people that we welcomed here in the church and the victims in Seriate, I saw more than 500 dead people in 2 months. Around 200 victims in Seriate in 2 months, 150 in March, 50 in April, plus the 250 corpses here in the church, on top of that, around 30 family members, friends and colleagues. In those 2 months, 24 priests died in Bergamo.
Una trentina di persone che conoscevo, solo i preti ne sono morti 24 in quei due mesi.
The San Giuseppe is a modern church built with brown orange bricks. On this spring morning, sunlight is shining through the window on the marble floor. The benches are neatly placed in line. A black and white photograph on the side wall is the only reminder of those dramatic weeks in the spring of 2020. Of all the people he lost in that period, Don Carminati especially remembers one of his volunteers, who ended up in the intensive care of Bergamo's hospital.
Giorno era un sabato, mi ha telefonato un'infermiera dall'ospedale.
It was a Saturday evening around 8:30 when a nurse from the hospital called me to announce another passing. That was the 10th phone call that day with that kind of news. She said she had a message for me from Mr. Pio, who was one of the volunteers that worked here in the church. She wanted to tell me that he had passed. Before he died, he asked the nurse to call me to give a message to his wife, as he wasn't able to talk to her, to tell her that he always loved her. That was maybe the hardest part of the pandemic. People died alone.
Morire ammalati, sentirsi soffocare e farlo da soli.
Walking through the streets of Bergamo's old city centre, it seems a prosperous and happy city. People are sitting on the terrace in the early spring sunshine, chatting and drinking coffee. Bergamo has bounced back from the pandemic, says ex-mayor Gori.
E questo si è visto in tante espressioni. Banalmente si è visto.
We've seen it in the economic figures. 2021 and 2022 were very good years economically. These are not the only parameters, but it says a lot about how the city reacted. It culminated in 2023 with the Italian Culture Capital Project. We wanted to give the image of a city that's recovering, not a city that was on its knees.
Tourism grew with 20% since the pandemic. Bergamo Airport has become the third largest in Italy, right after Rome and Milan. But underneath the economic prosperity, growing tourism and happy people drinking and chatting in the sun, the scars are still fresh. The city has changed, one young man on the city's main square tells me. He says he lost friends in the pandemic. The government, he says, didn't react well. Almost every Bergamasco had been touched by the pandemic. So despite the bustling high streets and thriving street cafes, forgetting is difficult. Angelo van Schaik, DW, Bergamo.
Bergamo may be booming, but the grief still remains. So what happens if it's not dealt with properly? Well, according to Sarah Jaffe, the answer to that question could have massive consequences for us all.
The thing that haunts me from that, there are a few things that haunt me from that bit of reporting in that chapter, but one thing was Francesca Nava, who's an Italian journalist that I spoke to, she said to me, you know, what's happened politically afterwards is people have voted for the politicians who said no more lockdown, because no one can guarantee no more pandemic. And that, I think, has been so telling of the shift in politics since COVID. This push to say in some ways that like the cure was worse than the disease, that has been really something that has stuck with me when I think about the rise of Giorgia Meloni in Italy, but also Trump's return to office in the US, the rise of the far right across Europe, that it is this reaction to this moment of profound trauma that we have not dealt with, and that the answer of sort of look forward, not backward, has been so not up to the task of dealing with what we all went through.
We'll be coming back to this idea later in the programme, when we'll be looking at the impacts of deindustrialisation and the weaponization of grief in the form of nostalgia. If you're listening to the shorter version of this programme via one of our partner stations, then you will still be able to hear all of that via our podcast feed. In the meantime, if you have a story of your own that you'd like to share with us, then please do get in touch via insideeurope@dw.com. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. From Bergamo to New Jersey, in From the Ashes, Sarah Jaffe explores the workplace organising which grew up not just around demands for adequate PPE and workplace safety, but for the right to grieve itself.
You have people who just had to get up and keep going, you know, and were told, right, that like, well, there are no funerals right now because COVID, so like, then you can just come back to work. You don't need the time off to grieve if there's no funeral to go to, as if like the funeral is the only time that we're grieving.
In the USA, this intersected with the mass public outpourings of grief and anger at the death of George Floyd and of so many other victims of racialized police violence, many of whom died like COVID victims, saying, "I can't breathe."
It does open something up. And you are able, I think, to imagine something different because it's no longer possible to deny that massive transformations are here.
Grief as a catalyst for social change. It's a current that I've been conscious of in many of the stories that we've been featuring on Inside Europe recently. The example that I gave Sarah was of our reporting from Serbia, where the deaths of 16 people in the Novi Sad train station disaster last year set in motion an anti-corruption protest movement which has already toppled a prime minister.
On Saturday, 15th of March, people from all over the country converged on Belgrade for the biggest protest yet.
Days ago when we talked, you said that the biggest issue is justice. Do you think justice will be served in Serbia?
Maybe not today, but sure it's coming. I can see in the people's face and everything. And
Sarah spoke about a similar phenomenon following a major train disaster in Greece, and also about the centrality that the demand for the right to mourn has taken in protests against the killing by Israeli soldiers of tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians trapped inside the Gaza Strip.
The thing that I think is powerful and has been incredibly powerful about the protests over the last year and however many months it's been, going on 2 years, has been that people are saying, we are going to grieve in public and we are going to come together and say, A, mourn for the dead and fight like hell for the living, which is a line from the labor organizer Mother Jones that has been used by groups like Jewish Voice for Peace in these protests, in these actions, to say, like, not in our names, right? That we will not actually allow Jewish grief over actual things that have happened to people who look like me. To be weaponized to do this to someone else, to do the same thing that happened to people who look like me, to other people who actually don't look that different from me either.
Sarah, who is Jewish, believes passionately in the universalism of grief.
The way that I took never again was to mean never again for anyone. And that means that I grieve for mothers and fathers and children in Gaza as much as I do for people who look like me, right? It is not good enough to say that I should identify with the state of Israel because it was founded by people who look like me. It is not enough to say that the Jews will be safe from another Holocaust if we just protect ourselves at all costs, because that just leaves us alone and isolated, and we have to build bigger walls and bigger guns and bigger bombs, and those failed, right? That October 7th was a reminder that those fail, and that putting people behind walls and holding them off with guns will never work forever, because there will always be ways to take those walls down. We will not be safe behind walls, whether it's Trump's border wall or the separation walls in Gaza. That we will only be safe if we recognize that everyone has to be safe.
It's been argued that grief is the only human experience that will be shared by everyone. At some point or another, grief is coming for us all. There is, Sarah believes, radical potential in that fact. And on a heating planet, where collective experiences of loss are touching ever more of us, grief might just emerge as the biggest force for social change that we have. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Thank you.
You're listening to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. In a break from usual programming this week, we're focusing in on the topic of grief and what it might mean to look at current events through the lens of loss. Not just personal loss, but collective, communal loss as well.
That's it. I mean, I worked on it. My father, he died of pneumoconiosis. He worked 40 years at the same pit. But he, at the finish, he thought, well, coal's had its day.
Because of the dangerous nature of the work, mining communities have traditionally been no stranger to grief. Indeed, the close-knit forms of solidarity and cultural expression which grow up around them are often rooted in a shared understanding of death as well as of life. But what happens when the work that held that shared sense of identity together disappears? In the 1700s, Britain provided 85% of the world's coal. But now, finally, the journey is over. In October 2024, the last coal power station shut down as the UK pivots towards renewable energy. It's a change that has to happen, but at what cost and to whom? In this specially commissioned feature, environmental journalist Dan Ashby takes us on a journey deep into what is arguably the most significant industrial change of our lifetimes.
It's a working man I am, and I've been down underground, and I swear to God if I ever see the sun, or for any length...
Deep in the Welsh Valleys, a group of gentlemen are singing their hearts out.
It's a working man I am.
This is not a theatre school. Instead, these men learn to sing down a mine. Male choirs like the Maesteg Gleeman are part of tradition here in Wales. But in this quiet working men's club, between beers and fizzy pop, you'll find a sadness behind the music and a warning for the rest of Europe.
The pits are finished, the finance is gone, and the brass bands are gone, aren't they?
You used to look in this, you'd walk up not far from the street and look at three pit head gears. The wheel is turning on three pits, 700, 1,000 working there, 800 working there. Where are all those jobs gone? Where are all those jobs gone?
How does Europe rid itself of coal in a fair way? Britain has already done it and bears the scars on its back. So what can Europe learn from our mistakes?
Here we go, road to Aberdare, getting higher, higher and higher and higher.
In this documentary, I'm travelling the UK to find out. And from Welsh choirs to English towns, everywhere I go, I see the marks of that story.
Cliffs going up and road upon road of miners' cottages.
Hundreds of years ago, Britain provided 85% of the world's coal. It's no stretch to say, coal built the Industrial Revolution, so I'm driving back in time to understand what we've lost. I arrive at Beamish Living Museum in County Durham, an entire 1950s mining village that's been preserved with hundreds of volunteer actors living a 50s life. But pop in to the miners' cottages and you'll find a roaring coal fireplace.
It feels lovely and traditional, doesn't it?
Yes.
I can see why they say it was the centre of the home, because now I see the full fireplace in its full glory. It is quite something.
It absolutely is. I mean, you would do everything on this fire. If you didn't have this range, then basically you couldn't do your daily chores, because without the range, you've got no food and no hot water, so...
Of course, I didn't think of the water, drying clothes, I just saw it as heat. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
The point is that coal was, and still is, much more than a black rock. It shaped the way our homes are built, our culture, even gender and psychology. And if Europe wants to close its 150-odd coal mines, not to mention ending coal imports, a good start is to fully understand what coal means to coal communities, as John Kindlysides, a historian from the museum, explains.
We shouldn't bury our heads in the sand and deny that we use coal. We should celebrate the fact that this part of the region was built on the coal industry, and a lot of our towns and villages wouldn't be the same, wouldn't in a lot of cases exist without coal. Yeah, it is. It's a very emotive subject. Any ex-miner, they all mourn the loss of the coal industry. It was an industry where there was a huge amount of camaraderie, and I think that's what most miners miss. It's not the actual digging the coal out of the ground. It's the life that went with it that they miss.
That sense of pride and loss has often gone undervalued.
So I started underground in 1985. And
Professor Keith Gildert is one of the country's leading coal history experts, and he says Europe must learn that lesson from the UK and make sure the world of coal miners and environmentalists mix.
If you look at environmental politics, it's been a predominantly, I kind of be careful with the term, but it has been predominantly a kind of middle class pressure group type movement. These would be kind of two different worlds. So I think, yeah, there is. I mean, there has been this kind of lack of conversation between the two.
That two-world mentality meant that Britain's closure of coal was at times confrontational, even brutal.
He knows that this strike, started by manipulation of union rules, has been maintained by violence and intimidation.
Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister most associated with killing coal. Her government closed more than 100 pits in a few years, sparking the iconic 1984 miners' strike.
Hands up vote, unanimously, to go on strike as from Monday morning.
I've arrived in South Yorkshire with ex-miner and ex-striker Alex Matheson. We're walking around the edges of a new housing estate, but this was once the fields of Orgreave, where the strike reached its climax. Even now, as we've just passed the 40th anniversary of that day, it's still raw. This is the first time that Alex has been back.
So there were people on the field physically fighting each other, policemen and pickets. There were missiles being thrown, but I've never seen ever in my life as much brutality from the police. My heart were in my mouth that day. So I had to run, and I could run at that time, and I had to run. Since there were no way, and I kept looking back to see who were near me, and all I could see were miners falling to the ground. And when I walked through the door, I'm a bit tearful now. Frightened me, honestly. That day, wow, heart were up here.
The police beat innocent miners to break them. The government followed with its own policy. Within 10 years, 180,000 had lost their jobs, with little support or economic management. Decades on, the same areas of the UK still suffer intergenerational poverty, and communities remain divided.
Did people fall out with them?
Yeah, so people don't speak today. In some of the villages, some of them had destroyed the marriages, lost the homes. Like, for instance, next door to my dad's, they come and painted his house red while his wife and two kids were in the house. And they threw cans and cans of red paint over his house, his council house, to show there are scab lives here.
He's saying that 40 years ago, people threw paint over the homes of those that went back to work early, and that even today, they're still outcast. Orgreave and the abrupt abandonment of coal communities in the 1980s has become the symbol of an unjust transition, where the poorest communities pay the price for an economic transformation. As Europe closes its coal power plants and moves to renewables, how can it avoid repeating that mistake? The good news is that already the EU has learned from the UK. The transition will be more planned, and there's funds to help coal workers transition to other industries. But Boyer Hoygaard at the Carbon Trust told me there's still a risk of division.
Those communities have a greater voice and a greater impact, but it still has a tendency for the coal mining communities to align to a certain political party, and therefore the impact on when the opposite political party is in power, you can still see that. So that's something to avoid.
And I guess if you don't get the just transition right, you often get frustration at energy policies, climate policies, as an expression of that. So just transition within Europe has to be central, otherwise it won't work.
Without popular consent, without bringing people along in general, then the energy transition will be slowed down.
So the big challenge for Europe is to try to keep its coal communities engaged. Simon Evans is from Carbon Brief and recently visited Germany's eastern coal region and says climate policies are often unfairly blamed for economic pain.
You know, the population there has plummeted. You know, the sort of sense of economic opportunity and employment is kind of slipped away. People just have left simply because there are no jobs, there's no opportunities. And that's actually really nothing to do with climate policy. It's nothing to do with the transition away from coal. It's just part of a wider shift that's been happening for entirely different reasons.
There are some answers that Europe can find in the UK to all these difficult problems, not least in how the UK managed coal's decline from the noughties on. And that came down to setting a deadline and having a vision.
We're now standing in my office looking out across...
That's Graham Miller, the former council leader of the British city of Sunderland, showing off the view from the council building. It's a great spot. You can see the whole city.
Over there where you can see the wind turbines, that is Nissan, and that is where the microgrid is going to go. So we're going to see a massive increase in the number of wind turbines and, of course, the solar panels, which will be on the ground giving Nissan and Envision.
Sunderland was built on coal and shipyards, but it's been voted one of the top cities in the world for climate ambition. That's in part because the UK legislated to phase out coal and subsidise the renewables market. Now Sunderland is planning to make its own electricity from wind and solar panels and to be carbon neutral by 2040.
But what you can see across to my right is the three Gen 2 tower blocks that are now using heat-sourced water to heat those buildings rather than having gas boilers in them. If you can see cranes, you're doing things. That's what people expect.
He believes that going green will bring money and jobs into Sunderland. And actually, being built on mines, because of all the water they hold, is an important part of the plan.
The water down there, if the ground conditions are right, it's about 60, 70 degrees, which is absolutely brilliant for heating houses and keeping everybody warm with a good source of hot water.
And on the issue of taking the community with you, have a listen to whether the people of Sunderland want to go back to the Black Rock.
No, not in 100 years. Dirty, terrible working conditions, dangerous, not paid anything like enough. Why would we want men and women to be doing that as a job now in the 21st century? The time for coal, in my opinion, has been. It gave us the Industrial Revolution, and we must thank that because it put Britain at the top of the pile regarding world powers at that time. But we're now talking 100 years ago. Right? We've now got the ability to have energy through other things. What Sunderland needs to discover...
And yet, even with models like Sunderland and the UK, Europe has its work cut out. 25 countries will have phased out coal by 2030, but another 12 either won't make that deadline, or in countries like Poland, haven't got a full plan to phase it out yet. Even Germany, seen as an environmental leader, says it'll phase out coal only by 2038. The re-election of Donald Trump and the rise of the far right in Europe have both made speeding up coal's demise much trickier. And as I left Sunderland, I didn't have to travel far to find ex-miners who are already rallying against climate progress.
The dinosaurs were wiped out by?
A meteorite.
Which did what? Climate change.
I've made it to a pub in Gateshead, where I'm having an argument with ex-miner Dave Douglas.
And the species that existed before the dinosaurs were wiped out by what?
But
climate change.
But isn't that an argument to say we don't want it to happen again?
Of course we don't want it to happen again, but what I'm trying to say to you is we can't stop climate change. There can't be any rational debate with anybody on the subject of climate change if people think they can stop climate change.
Well, we could stop man-made climate change, surely, because that's self-evidently true.
We could if we all committed mass suicide. We could stop man-made climate change if we don't contribute anything at all. But to think you can run away from the greatest source of power in the world, we're not going to stop using fossil fuels. Let me say to Greta, how dare you take away the future of people who've gotten out when you live in a very comfortable living room in Sweden with a professional mum and dad.
The argument went on long into the evening, until I left, exhausted. Despite that, people like Dave are still in the minority. Unlike in the US over the past 30 years, the UK has cultivated that rarest of political things, a consensus. It is fragile and complicated and sometimes contested, but most people now agree coal is better left underground. And if you need any better illustration of why, then perhaps it's time to go underground yourself.
And so keep your hats on and mind your heads.
So we're walking into what was once a working drift mine, and I'm not very tall and I'm having to duck here. In the northeast of England, ex-miner Eric Foster shows me the ropes by leading me into a dark, dank, huge drift mine, the weight of a hillside above us. And this would have been loud. Loud, dirty, noisy, wet.
Wet. The machine itself is 10 times louder than a normal road digger.
Wow, and that's all day?
People that's all day, 8 hours a day with that machine. If you're working in there, you'll be working in there for 8 hours, lying down.
In a hole that size? So
that size. I mean,
18 inches. I mean,
that's 18 inches. Sometimes you might get less than 18 inches.
It's barely bigger than a cereal box, if you can imagine that.
I've got a scar, actually, on my brow where I hit myself with a shovel.
Coal has stuck to you through
it's
your life.
It's stuck to me.
You can't get rid of it.
Can't get away from it. I was from a coal mining family.
Yeah.
When we went to school, if your father didn't work in a coal mine, there was something the matter with him.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it used to be like.
And to think that so many British people's lives played out in places like this.
Between 1870 and 1950, in the UK, there was 96,000 men killed underground.
We emerge back into the light to make sense of that. And now here we are, you know, end of coal, really. There's no big coal mines left in the UK. We know the environmental legacy, but it's also had a big cultural, economic impact on our country. How should we remember it? Should we be glad that it's gone? Or?
Well, personally, being an ex-coal miner, coal's had its day. You know, it's finished. We can just remember it. Kids don't know what coal is. They've never seen coal before.
But should we be glad that it's gone?
Personally, yes.
Wow, you're the first ex-miner who's told me that.
That's it. I mean, I worked down pit. My father, he died of pneumoconiosis. He worked 40 years at the same pit. But he, at the finish, he thought, well, coal's had its day.
Today, coal's legacy in British life is both fading and instrumental. You can see its legacy in pubs and cities and so much culture. This journey has taught me that that legacy is bittersweet for so many.
It underpinned the Industrial Revolution and these kind of rich, vibrant communities that built their own cultures.
We're a proud people, and our contribution to society has been unbelievable.
We clawed for coal. We built this country around coal, you mean?
So the question for Europe is whether it can pull off its own green transformation without leaving a legacy of pain and loss in its wake. Dan Ashby, DW, in the UK.
To the dark recess of the mines, where you age before your time, and the coal dust lies heavy on your...
What might mourning the dead and fighting like hell for the living look like in the context of modern-day deindustrialisation? We'll be back with analysis from Sarah Jaffe after the break. That's Here With Me, Kate Laycock, on Inside Europe. If you've tuned into Fox News lately, then you are sure to have encountered the idea that deindustrialization is directly linked to a supposed loss of masculinity, or at least masculine purpose and dignity. And you'll hear voices in the UK making the same argument, and not just on the right of the political spectrum.
When for so long we sort of tell people that the thing that makes you a man is you do hard work and you don't complain about it and you don't talk about your feelings at all, maybe, right? You just go to work and you do your job and you bring home the paycheck and you support your family. And now you can't do any of those things because the job is gone. The job you have in place of it is not that kind of work and it doesn't support your family. All of these sort of bricks in the wall of what it takes to be a man, and particularly a working class man, that's gone. And again, sort of like the people are voting for who said no more lockdown because they can't say no more pandemic. They are voting for people who are saying we are going to like restore gender roles. Trump's first executive order was men are men and women are women. The thing that nobody's offering is good jobs, right? Like Donald Trump is literally trying to dismantle union rights in the US. Union rights were what made those jobs decent in the first place. They are literally making jobs worse, but promising that they will bring back gender by executive order.
Bring back traditional gender roles, bring back the combustion engine, bring back manufacturing. Somehow, these things have all become confused in public discourse, and that's on both sides of the Atlantic. It's a phenomenon that has got Sarah Jaffe thinking of Sigmund Freud's essay on mourning and melancholia.
His argument in that piece is that melancholia is sort of a grief you can't let go of, that curdles in a way, right? That this refusal to let go of the lost object is dangerous and it pulls you down, right? And nostalgia is this very similar thing, right? Where you cling to the attachment to something that is not coming back. And the increasingly sort of panicked and violent attempts to restore something that is not coming back. That is, I think, at the core of so much of, I mean, make America great again, right? What do they mean by great? What is the greatness that they are going to restore? If we look at Trump's first executive orders, it is masculinity and whiteness, right? It is getting rid of the immigrants and it is restoring traditional gender roles. It is a profoundly sort of backward-looking idea that is what we need to restore by having borders and deporting people and insisting that men are men and wiping out, you know, DEI, which is the new whatever, diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? That sense of, you know, of sort of cleansing, frankly, to a view of something that was the way we never were, and B, like, even if it was, that way of being set the planet on fire.
So what's the alternative? Presumably a just transition, a pivot towards greener, more future-facing industries, which puts the need for decent jobs in the local community at its heart, has to be a big part of it. But as anyone who has ever experienced deep loss will tell you, before you can move on and remake your life into something new, you first have to allow yourself and be allowed by others to grieve.
In Mourning and Melancholia, Freud is arguing that the work of mourning is sort of to systematically detach yourself from all of these memories. And I was like, but that's not what's happening at all. Like, rather, I'm grappling for a future that I can't imagine.
And often, Sarah believes, that future is to be glimpsed in the relationships that develop when we come together to express our shared pain. This is what happened in the UK during the miners' strike in the 1980s, when a group of London-based LGBTQ activists turned up in a mining village in Wales to offer their support and their recognition of the parallels with their own experience of police brutality and media stigmatisation. It's a story that you might recognise if you've seen the movie Pride.
I think everybody should watch. It's incredible. It will just, like, make you feel good about the world. Even though the miners lost, right? They were facing something that actually, you know, federal workers who are facing Donald Trump right now are facing, which is, like, it's very hard to win a strike when what your opponent wants is to fire you. And, you know, some of the people who were involved in Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners were from mining communities, right? They were from industrial communities. Michael, who I spoke to from LGSM, right? He was from the north of England. He was from an industrial area. Like, this was not just like, oh, parallels. These were their communities in some ways. And they had left those communities because there was no place for them there. But that solidarity, and again, it was material, right? They started out just, you know, taking buckets and wandering around London and collecting money for the miners. And then they reached out and they found a particular miners, you know, union branch in Wales that would take their donations. And they went there and they said, you know, we don't want to just like send you money from afar. We want to show up. We want to be in real connection with these people. And the movie ends with the fact that the miners' union was the first major union in Britain to come out and support LGBT rights, right? And to say, like, this community showed up for us. They taught us stuff about ourselves that we didn't even really know. That changed the way this entire union understood gender, right? The questions of deindustrialization are so often around masculinity. And I found it really, really interesting to talk to people who had just had their ideas of what, you know, masculinity and relationships and care looked like changed by this exchange between these two groups of people.
As my conversation with Sarah Jaffe draws to a close, I'm reminded of a line which I think comes from Rebecca Solnit, another US author whose thinking has been profoundly influenced by the experience of New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. When things fall apart, we fall together.
The relationships that I have in my life now are deeper and more profound and more trusting, and that's occasionally terrifying to me, that these people who love me have seen so much of my vulnerability. It's been terrifying to me, as I said at the beginning, to be this vulnerable talking about this book. But it's also been a just a tremendous gift to imagine that we can keep expanding this outward, that we can keep taking care of each other, that this could be the way we think about the world, rather than dog eat dog, every man for himself.
Sarah, I think the rain has stopped.
I think it has.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you. This has been great.
My thanks to Sarah Jaffe, author of From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire, for being my guide during this Inside Europe special on grief and what it might mean to look at current events through the lens of loss. Thanks also to Angelo van Schaik and Dan Ashby for their contributions from Bergamo and former UK mining districts, respectively. If you have any thoughts or experiences that you would like to share on the ideas that we've been exploring in this programme, then please do get in touch via insideeurope@dw.com. And if you need support, then please do reach out to the relevant organisations in your own country or even just a friend. Our producer this week was Sam Baker, and our sound engineer was Gerd Georgi, with additional support from Christian Steter. Inside Europe is brought to you by DW in Bonn.